designing aircraft to protect occupants. How do they know what the human body can take? I'm Paul Fleck, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading today. My guest today is George Bible, author of Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes. And George is a professor of mechanical engineering and has done a lot of research on this topic and has written a book that turns out tells us not only a lot about the way airplanes are designed, but also a lot about what is known about the human body and in protecting it in traumatic circumstances such as airplane crashes. George, thanks for taking some time out to come back and talk to our listeners today.
Thanks for inviting me.
You have two fascinating chapters in your book. They're chapters 8 and 9 called Crash Testing and Human Tolerances to G-Loads and Crash Forces, respectively. Let's start for a moment by talking about human tolerances. There's some fascinating research. I think that when people, if someone goes for their first aerobatic ride and finds themselves having uncomfortable experiences at 2.5 or 3 Gs, they might be astounded to know what the human body can withstand. Some of this research comes from some pretty dark places.
Yes, well, I start chapter 9 with ejection from Blue Angels. A guy was doing the opening scene of their show, went into a dive and started it and realized he wasn't high enough and pulled out the last minute, remarkably, just a few feet before he crashed. And went in the hospital for observation. He got up to hug his wife, and he was 2 inches shorter. So he was probably pulling 17 or 18 Gs, and it shrunk him. Most of it came back after a few months.
I think you said in the book he eventually regained all but about a half inch of that height. That's remarkable. That's a real-life circumstance, and obviously the ejection seat in which he was sitting was already designed with some knowledge of human tolerances. Where did we get that knowledge? I mean, go back further. Where does this all come from?
The study in detail were the Germans during World War II. They started using ejection seats on their high-performance airplanes, especially the jets. And when you shoot someone up an ejection seat, it's the exact same thing as crashing downward. In both cases, they try to compress your spine. And they concluded on average that each vertebrae is loaded with about 1,500 pounds of force at about 25 Gs, and 25 Gs will fracture your spine. And in fact, a 1,500 pounds loading makes its way into FAA requirements on seat crash tests today. They'll have a load cell mounted in the spine of the crash dummy, and it can't exceed 1,500 pounds of load.
All right. Now, when I think of sitting in, a car seat or an airline seat, these are not as controlled an environment as an ejection seat in a fighter plane or even the seats that are built into some high performance smaller aircraft. What other kinds of injuries are involved in crashes that we would have to consider as possible causes of injury?
Well, the Navy has a handbook out, and they have a few these are hard to get a handle on. They're very much dependent on duration, and obviously you can't test people to destruction, but they've got a lot of testing. They tested animals. They talk about total body fragmentation at 300 Gs. I think it's analogous to a water balloon going splat. I think it's exactly analogous because, what are we, 70% water? And also I looked a lot at Colonel Stapp during the 50s. They were trying to study ejection seats for Mach 2 planes that coming out, and he pulled 46 Gs horizontally with military-type straps and harnesses, and he went temporarily blind. He ruptured blood vessels in his eyes, and other testing, he did, I don't know, I think maybe 20-some tests. He cracked his ribs, broke his wrist twice, had a couple concussions. Can you imagine doing that, having a concussion or cracking your ribs and getting back up on the horse and riding it again?
I was going to say that would be the hardest thing, I would think, for any of these guys to do. But I guess if you want to test those boundaries, somebody's got to do it. You related a fascinating incident in your book regarding G-suits. First of all, tell us what a G-suit is and what it does.
Well, it squeezes mostly the bottom of the body to prevent blood from pooling in it. And a Canadian got the idea during World War II. I guess World War I is the first time people came aware of it. They go into a dive and pull out and was aware of blood rushing out of their head. And this guy was doing cancer research. He'd be spinning test tubes in a centrifuge, and they kept breaking. And he finally solved the problem as he put his test tube into a bigger test tube surrounded by water, the idea being his test tube and the water would equally get heavier under the acceleration of G's and it balanced. So he thought, well, heck, why can't we do this on people? So first test he did was he took a mouse and put it in a condom and filled it with water, and it withstood 240 G's, and he thought he was onto something.
Yeah.
So he did in fact, develop the first G-suit, and they tried it a little bit, but they thought it was so great in World War II, they kept it a secret. They were afraid the Germans would find out about it when their planes crashed. They were going to use it during D-Day in the final climactic air battle over the landings, but by then the war had totally changed. They were, you know, fighters were on these long flights to Berlin, and it wasn't very comfortable sitting in a suit filled with water for 8 hours.
Well, G-suits persist to this day, though, in some applications in the military, do they not?
Yes, they do, but they've changed them. They're now air-filled. There's still people looking at water-filled. They'd respond quicker and automatically, but the standard today is air-filled. And I guess I forgot to mention the known record we know about is Captain 1958 withstood 83 G's for 0.04 of a second. He went unconscious, went into shock, and he was hospitalized for 3 days, but he fully recovered.
Wow. Without skeletal injuries? Or?
As far as I know, yes.
Well, it's pretty remarkable. Well, we have two different things to think about, I suppose, in a military plane, and that is protecting people from injury and also keeping the pilot alert and conscious. When we come back from the break, let's talk about how some of these principles apply to airline travel, because I think that's one of the more fascinating parts of the book here. Talking to George Bible, who is the author of Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways. And you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and known ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today with George Bible, author of Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes. We're talking about the human body's tolerance to G-forces and other kinds of injurious effects in a traumatic event involving an airplane. And we want to move on to the crash testing of airplanes. And George, here again, if someone reads this chapter in your book, the thing that strikes me is the amount of money, time, effort, brain power, computer resources that have been devoted to testing these effects. One of the first pictures in Chapter 8 in your book is of a controlled impact demonstration aircraft that was apparently a NASA experiment, and they literally filled an airliner with crash test dummies.
Yes, that was 1984, sponsored by the FAA and NASA, and it was a Boeing 720, which is kind of a shortened version of a 707. And that's probably the most photographed, studied, instrumented crash in history. And there's a few really cool videos posted on NASA's Dryden site that I think you'll be able to link to.
Yes, we can. And I have seen them, and it's remarkable. And they had it looks like they had cameras in a number of different locations, both external to the plane, in the cockpit, in the cabin, located on various surfaces of the plane. One of the most striking things about that video, though, is the failure of what was hoped to be a very effective fire suppression system.
Yes, they had studied very successfully adding an additive to the fuel to prevent misting and post-crash fire. It was a long-chain microscopic molecule, a polymer molecule that would minimize misting. The problem is it would gum up the engine, so they had to remove it before the fuel went into the engine. And this additive does work, but when they crashed, they planned on ripping open the wing tank engines, and they were off a little bit and ripped open the actual engine. So you had this fuel with the additive removed pouring on all these hot engine parts, and it really never had a chance to work. There's a rumor the Secretary of Transportation witnessed the crash and kind of stormed out of the room and said, "Don't ask me to support this again." And I tend to believe it because before the crash, there's a massive amount of reports and studies on this additive. And then after the crash, it's like someone flicked the switch. Nothing exists.
Well, yeah. If you find the end of the file drawer and there's nothing left, it means somebody turned a switch off somewhere.
Yes.
What was this particular test trying to achieve other than a test of this fire suppression system?
Well, they also installed more crash-worthy seats, and that didn't work either. Actually, it didn't hit as hard as they had hoped. It didn't activate essentially some seats with shock absorbers, and the concept never caught on. They don't exist in commercial planes. And it hit with about 14 Gs, which is actually an extremely survivable crash. Except for the fire, the crash was not that big a deal in impact. And in fact, the FAA estimated 15 of the 59 simulated passengers would have survived the fireball, which is really remarkable if you get a chance to see the video.
Yeah, we're going to link people to that video from the data block that accompanies this Aerocast. If you see that fireball, and I assume that the video that shows the varying views, including the inside of the cabin, that those shots are interposed in their correct timing sequence, and a spectacular-looking fireball on the outside initially doesn't result in any fire on the inside of that plane.
Well, there was fire on the inside and a lot of smoke. You don't see it that well in the videos.
Okay.
And you got to remember all the combustible plastic upholstery inside the plane. Everything is burns.
Well, what did we end up learning from this crash? I know they subsequently did drop testing of simulated fuselage sections with seats in them. If this was done in the 80s, have there been significant improvements in airliner safety since these tests?
Well, there's been a lot of drop tests of fuselage sections. They usually drop them. They did a lot of drop tests from 6.2 feet and 14 feet, which is kind of amazing. Everyone worries about falling from 40,000 feet, but they're trying to simulate a bad landing. So at 6 feet, it hits at 20 feet per second, and 14 feet, it hits at 30 feet per second. And for example, I guess Boeing surveyed pilots, and they'll report a hard landing. In other words, Mr. Mechanic, take a look. I think I might have bounced too hard at just 4 feet per second. And they're designed the landing gear for 6 feet per second at the heavy takeoff weight and 10 feet per second for the heavier landing. Above 25 feet per second, they expect significant fatalities, as I show up. Couple plots in my book.
Well, now, I was told when I first got into flying, or I was actually overhearing someone else being told, someone was worried about flight at 10,000 feet as opposed to flight at 1,000 feet. And the instructor just turned to this particular woman and said, you know, once you get above the height of a stepladder, it's all kind of the same. And altitude only buys you more options. That's counterintuitive to a lot of people.
Yes, it is. For example, that 10 feet per second design for the landing gear, that's a drop of just 19 inches. It's just pretty amazing.
Is there anything that has surprised you? I mean, you have a background that obviously includes some physics and mechanical engineering. What popped out at you when you were doing the research for these chapters in the book?
Well, I was a little surprised at just how few large planes have been crashed on purpose. In the early 80s, they crashed, I think it was 23 small planes. They had this a gantry left over from Apollo, where it was basically a big pendulum that practiced the lunar landing module. So they swung 23 small planes into the ground. But the number of big planes is extremely limited. But they did a lot more of these section tests, and they've done a lot of work trying to sort out computer modeling of crash testing. There's been a lot of progress with that.
Well, have they learned enough from analyzing actual crashes to maybe alleviate the need to do some of these on-purpose ones?
Well, they more or less did that. The big ones, they came up with essentially the spec on the seat crash test. That's a lot more commonly done. Anytime you modify a seat, it has to go through crash testing. And they, just in the last 10 years or so, they upgraded the standards on that. It used to be a 9G static test. In other words, they pull on it nine times the design weight, and now they require a 16G actual crash test. The thing moves on a test fixture at 44 feet per second and comes to a stop in less than 2/10 of a second. And that will create 16 Gs of impact force.
Well, 44 feet per second sticks in my mind because that's exactly 30 miles an hour. So that's the equivalent of, do they put weight in the seat that simulates a typical passenger and then drive it into some stationary object at 30 miles an hour?
Well, no, they'll have a crash dummy, and he'll have an accelerometer in his head and a load cell in his spine, and he's got to have less than 1,500 pounds in his force in his spine, and he's got to have acceleration that's been correlated with actual drop tests of cadaver heads that they think predicts a skull fracture.
Wow. So the seat's purpose is not to remain rigid in order to prevent crushing injuries. Its purpose is to intentionally deform enough to reduce the acceleration forces on the human body.
Yeah, well, next time you get on a airplane, look at the seat structure, and it sure looks pretty flimsy. Now, they're very concerned about saving weight on anything on an airplane, but yes, it's designed to deform during a crash.
Well, George, some of this stuff is remarkable, and I haven't seen it really put together anyplace else. When you finished this book, did you feel safer riding on airliners?
Yeah, one reviewer said, in spite of describing crash after crash after crash, you're left with the feeling that flying is pretty darn safe. Because I also explained a lot of the safety improvements they made after every crash. So, and also how intensively they investigate these things and get to the root cause. So that's a pretty impressive effort.
The book is Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes. The author is George Bible. George, tell our listeners again, what is the optimum way to get the book?
Well, it's available on Amazon, and you can order it from Barnes & Noble. It's in their computer, unfortunately. It's in a pretty limited number of stores.
Okay. Well, I would guess then that Amazon would be a fairly safe bet.
Yes.
Well, George, thanks very much for not only for talking with us and with our listeners today, but also for writing this book, because I found it a great read, and I tend to be a little on the nerd side anyway. I enjoy books that go into the engineering and physics behind some of the things in our world, and this book does a particularly great job of that, and I would recommend it to any of our listeners. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, and it's only $20 on Amazon.
Okay, George Bible has been my guest. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.